19th as a federal holiday. In weather today, in Washington, it is currently 81 degrees under cloudy skies. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
I'm Gifford Phillips, and I'm associate, formerly publisher of Frontier Magazine, and after the happy wedding that took place between our two publications last week, I'm now associate publisher of The Nation magazine. And before introducing the distinguished guests at the head table, I would like to introduce my colleague of some 20 years who is in the audience, the former editor of Frontier Magazine, now associate editor of The Nation magazine, Phil Kirby. Phil, will you stand for a minute, please? I'm going to introduce the guests of honor at the head table, and will you please hold your applause till the end. There seem to be some that are they're a peripatetic lot. They don't all seem to be here, but I'll introduce those who are. On my left, Ed Mosk, co-chairman of the conference. Next to him, Carrie McWilliams, editor of The Nation magazine. Please hold your applause. On my right, James Starrow, a publisher of The Nation magazine. Next to him, a man who needs no introduction, Dr. Martin Luther King. Next to him, Robert Vaughn, co-chairman of the conference. And on his right, Mr. Jack Spitzer, participant in the conference. There was just a slight pause there, Jack, that was apparently meaningful. Now my pleasure to turn the program over to James Starrow.
Thank you, Gift. I can't begin to tell you all what an honor and a pleasure it's going to be to work with an associate like Gifford Phillips, and to have on our staff such a man as Phil Kirby as associate editor, something I look forward to. Now I have some rather unfortunate and doleful news. We had hoped to have here Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh of Detroit, and circumstances conspired against his coming. He has sent the remarks which he would have made, and rather than make them myself, which would be only anticlimactic, I can assure you all they will appear in the published record of this conference. Now, one other thing about those remarks. They are the remarks of a mayor of a large city on the what is happening to the large cities of this country as a result of the war and as a result of the expenditures that are being made. Those remarks are concurred with, I think, by many, many of our large city mayors. One in particular I know concurs with them is Mayor Naftalin of Minneapolis. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Mr. Vaughn.
Thank you, Mr. Storrow. It's a great honor to be a co-chairman of a meeting with so many distinguished visitors, and an even greater delight to see such a large crowd assembled here. It seems that we have representatives of all the societal structure of the area, with the possible exception of Sam Yorty's travel agent, who is a little busy. But it's a great honor. Throughout the history of mankind, diversity has been viewed as an enemy, and self-satisfied men have forever feared change, even though the ultimate alternative to change has been extinction. Some so-called change has hardly been change at all, but simply the replacing of a familiar condition with another. While actual change, having like everything else of dimension two sides, can evolve the spirit of man or retard it. This reluctance to change is the fear of the unknown. Yet, if any change has ever been created in the human condition, it has occurred and evolved only at the rate in which man challenged those unknowns. To resist change is to refuse to evolve, while to seek change can be man's most heroic act. Intolerance can be likened to a fortress. Within the fortress lies status quo, consensus, and a limited comfort. Outside is exposure, vulnerability, and discovery. Outside is change. Now, to live within the fortress is to live with fear. To live without is to live with courage. Gifted men have long attempted to lay siege to that fortress of intolerance, or sometimes more subtly, have invited those within to come out and enjoy the pleasures and creativities of freedom. History records her unusual men. Of these, she honors but a few, the insightful few. Armed with the power of truth, moved by love, with the courage to brave man's archaic defenses in hopes of setting him free from his always debilitating fears. In other words, to change him. Not to take away from him what he is, but to give him more of what he might be. If Martin Luther King's strivings were to be evaluated, certainly among the most impressive would be that the means defines the ends, that the silence of good men is not peace, and that change must be wrought. Truth never damages a cause that is just. We are honored today with the presence of a man whose only armor has been truth, whose cause has been just, whose courage and dignity have elevated all of us. Edmund Burke remarked, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." Racism is evil, and the history books will not record that Martin Luther King stood silent and did nothing while intolerance, inequality, and racism triumphed in this republic. Dr. King.
Mr. Storer, Mr. McWilliams, other distinguished platform guests, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to have the privilege of being a part of this very significant conference. And in the very beginning, I want to express my deep personal appreciation to my friend Robert Vaughn for these very kind and gracious words of introduction. It's always good to be in California and to renew old friendships and fellowships, and I'm happy to share the platform with
friends that I've known all along. I see Jack Tenner's here with us today, and he's been a great supporter of our work in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, he's a great fundraiser, and one evening we were having a fundraising meeting at the home of Bert Lancaster, and when he got to making the appeal, my associate Ralph Abernathy said, "You sound like a good Baptist preacher." So whenever he talks to you about money, you better hold your pocketbook very closely. But we're happy to be here with all of these friends. And of course, whenever I come to California, particularly when I take the flight out of New York or Chicago, I'm always happy to get on the ground, because the flight over the Rockies, you know, is usually very turbulent. And after a turbulent flight, I am always happy to land. I don't want to give anybody here the impression that I don't have faith in God in the air. It's simply that I've had more experience with him on the ground. Let me say briefly how happy I am to be here under the auspices of Nation Magazine. Through its journalistic integrity and its genuine liberalism, certainly this magazine has carved for itself an imperishable niche in the annals of journalistic history in our nation. And I know those of us who are readers and subscribers of Nation Magazine are deeply indebted to it for all that it has done to make the discussion of the vital issues of our day and our age a reality. I think we can all say, I'm sure Nation would appreciate that applause you're about to give. And certainly in these days of emotional tension, when the problems of the world are gigantic in extent and chaotic in detail, there is no greater need than for sober thinking, healthy debate, creative dissent, and enlightened discussion. And I think this is why this particular symposium is so important. And so this afternoon, I would like to speak to you candidly, and I hope forthrightly, about our present involvement in Vietnam. And I have chosen as a subject from which to speak the casualties of the war in Vietnam. We are certainly all aware of the nightmarish physical casualties of this war. We see them in our living rooms in all of their tragic dimensions on television screens, and we read about them on our subway and bus rides in daily newspaper accounts. We see the rice fields of a small Asian country being trampled at will and burned at whim. We see grief-stricken mothers with crying babies clutched tightly in their arms as they watch their little huts burst forth into flames. We see the fields and valleys of battle being painted with humankind's blood. We see the broken bodies left prostrate in countless fields. Most tragic of all is the casualty list among children. It is estimated that some 1 million Vietnamese children have been casualties of this brutal war, a war in which children are incinerated by napalm, in which American soldiers die in mounting numbers, while other American soldiers, according to press accounts, in unrestrained hatred, shoot the wounded enemy as they lie on the ground. Men to rise up with righteous indignation and oppose the very nature of this evil war. But the physical casualties of the war in Vietnam are not alone the catastrophes. The casualties of principles and values are equally disastrous and injurious. If the casualties of principle are not healed, the physical casualties will continue to mount. One of the first casualties of the war in Vietnam was the Charter of the United Nations. In taking armed action against the Viet Cong and North Vietnam, the United States clearly violated the UN Charter, which provides in Chapter 1, Article 2, that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. And in Chapter 7, it states that the Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and shall make recommendations or shall decide what measures shall be taken to maintain or restore international peace and security. It is very obvious that our government blatantly violated its obligation under the Charter of the UN to submit to the Security Council its charge of aggression against North Vietnam. Instead, we unilaterally launched an all-out war on Asian soil. In the process, we have undermined the purpose of the UN and caused its effectiveness at many points to atrophy. We have also placed our nation in the position of being morally and politically isolated. Even the long-standing allies of America have adamantly refused to join our government in this ugly war. As Americans and lovers of democracy, we should carefully ponder the consequence of our nation's declining moral status in the world. The second casualty of the war in Vietnam is the principle of self-determination. By entering a war that is little more than a domestic civil war, America has ended up supporting a new form of colonialism covered up by certain niceties of complexity. Whether we realize it or not, our participation in the war in Vietnam is an ominous expression of our lack of sympathy for the oppressed, our paranoid anti-communism, our failure to feel the ache and anguish of the have-nots. It reveals our willingness to continue participation in neo-colonialist adventures. A brief look at the background and history of this war reveals with brutal clarity the ugliness of our policy. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after the combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by the now well-known Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of her former colony. President Truman felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence. And we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese people have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war costs. Even before the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they began to despair of their reckless action. But we did not. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost the will. And during this period, United States governmental officials began to brainwash the American public. John Foster Dulles assiduously sought to prove that Indochina was essential to our security against the Chinese communist peril. When a negotiated settlement of the war was reached in 1954 through the Geneva Accord, it was done against our will. After doing all that we could to sabotage the planning for the Geneva Accord, we finally refused to sign it. Soon after this, we helped install Premier Diem. We supported him in his betrayal of the Geneva Accord and his refusal to have the promised 1956 election. We watched with approval as he engaged in ruthless and bloody persecution of all opposition forces. When Diem's infamous actions finally led to the formation of the National Liberation Front, the American public was duped into believing that the civil rebellion was being waged by puppets from Hanoi. As Douglas Pike wrote, "And horrid Americans helplessly watched Diem tear apart the fabric of Vietnamese society more effectively than the communists had ever been able to do. It was the most efficient act of his entire career. Since Diem's death, we have actively supported another dozen military dictatorships, all in the name of fighting for freedom. When it became evident that these regimes could not defeat the Viet Cong, we began steadily to increase our forces, calling them military advisors rather than soldiers. Today we are fighting an all-out war, undeclared by Congress. We have well over 300,000 American servicemen fighting in that benighted and unhappy country. American planes are bombing the territory of another country, and we are committing atrocities equal to any perpetrated by the Viet Cong. This is the third largest war in American history. All of this reveals that we are in an untenable position, morally and politically. We are left standing before the world glutted by our own barbarity. We are engaged in a war that seeks to turn the clock of history back and perpetuate white colonialism. And the greatest irony and tragedy of it all is that our nation, which initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world, is now cast in the mold of being an arch anti-revolutionary. A third casualty of the war in Vietnam is the Great Society. This confused war has played havoc with our domestic destinies. Despite feeble protestations to the contrary, the promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam. The pursuit of this widened war has narrowed domestic welfare programs, making the poor white and Negro bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home. And while the anti-poverty program is cautiously initiated, zealously supervised, and evaluated for immediate results, billions are liberally expended for this ill-considered war. The recently revealed misestimate of the war budget amounts to $10 billion for a single year. This error alone is more than five times the amount committed to anti-poverty programs. The security we profess to seek in foreign adventures, we will lose in our decaying cities. The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities for a decent America. If we reversed investments and gave the armed forces the anti-poverty budget, the generals could be forgiven if they walked off the battlefield in disgust. Poverty... poverty, urban problems, and social progress generally are ignored when the guns of war become a national obsession. When it is not our security that is at stake, but questionable and vague commitments to reactionary regimes, values disintegrate into foolish and adolescent slogans. It is estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. We have escalated the war in Vietnam and de-escalated the skirmish against poverty. It challenges the imagination to contemplate what lives we could transform if we were to cease killing. At this moment in history, it is irrefutable that our world prestige is pathetically frail. Our war policy excites pronounced contempt and aversion virtually everywhere, even when some national governments, for reasons of economic and diplomatic interest, do not condemn us. Their people, in surprising measure, have made clear they do not share the official policy. We are isolated in our false values in a world demanding social and economic justice. We must undergo a vigorous reordering of our national priorities. A fourth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the humility of our nation. Through rugged determination, scientific and technological progress, and dazzling achievements, America has become the richest and most powerful nation in the world. We have built machines that think and instruments that peer into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. We have built gargantuan bridges to span the seas and gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. Through our airplanes and spaceships, we have dwarfed distance and placed time in chains. And through our submarines, we have penetrated oceanic depths. This year, our national gross product will reach the astounding figure of $780 billion. All of this is a staggering picture of our great power. But honesty impels me to admit that our power has often made us arrogant as a nation. We feel that our money can do anything. We arrogantly feel that we have everything to teach other nations and nothing to learn from them. We often arrogantly feel that we have some divine messianic mission to police the whole world. We are arrogant in not allowing young nations to go through the same growing pains, turbulence, and revolution that characterized our history. We are arrogant in our contention that we have some sacred mission to protect people from totalitarian rule, while we make little use of our power to end the evils of South Africa and Rhodesia, and while we in fact support dictatorships with guns and money under the guise of fighting communism. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for war in Vietnam. And these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against a fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. Of all the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad, he has twice that of whites. And thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and he has half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The rate of infant mortality among Negroes is double that of whites. There were twice as many Negroes in combat in Vietnam at the beginning of 1967, and twice as many died in action in proportion to their numbers in the population as whites. All of this reveals that our nation has not yet used its vast resources of power to end the long night of poverty, racism, and man's inhumanity to man. Enlarged power means enlarged peril. If that is not concomitant growth of the soul, genuine power is the right use of strength. If our nation's strength is not used responsibly and with restraint, it will be, following Lord Acton's dictum, power that tends to corrupt, and power that corrupts an absolute power that corrupts absolutely. Our arrogance can be our doom. It can bring the curtains down on our national drama. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. And we are challenged in these turbulent days to use our power to speed up the day when every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked places shall be made straight and the rough places plain. A fifth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the principle of dissent, an ugly, repressive sentiment to silence peace seekers. Depicts advocates of immediate negotiation under terms of the Geneva Agreement and persons who call for a cessation of bombings in the North as quasi-traitors, fools, or venal enemies of our soldiers and institutions. Free speech and the privilege of dissent and discussion are rights being shut down by bombers in Vietnam. When those who stand for peace are so vilified, it is time to consider where we are going and whether free speech has not become one of the major casualties of the war. Curtailment of free speech is rationalized on grounds that a more compelling American tradition forbids criticism of the government when the nation is at war. More than a century ago, when we were in a declared state of war with Mexico, a first-term congressman by the name of Abraham Lincoln stood in the halls of Congress and fearlessly denounced that war. Congressman Abraham Lincoln of Illinois had not heard of this tradition, or he was not inclined to respect it, nor had Thoreau and Emerson and many other philosophers who shaped our democratic principles. Nothing can be more destructive of our fundamental democratic traditions than the vicious effort to silence dissenters. A sixth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the prospects of mankind's survival. This war has created the climate for greater armament and further expansion of destructive nuclear power. One of the most persistent ambiguities that we face is that everybody talks about peace as a goal. However, it does not take sharpest-eyed sophistication to discern that while everybody talks about peace, peace has become practically nobody's business among the power wielders. call the roll of those who sing the glad tidings of peace, and one's ears will be surprised by the responding sounds. The heads of all of the nations issue clarion calls for peace, yet these destiny determiners come accompanied by a band and a brigade of national choristers, each bearing unsheathed swords rather than olive branches. The stages of history are replete with the chants and choruses of the conquerors of old who came killing in pursuit of peace. Alexander, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Charlemagne, and Napoleon were akin in their seeking a peaceful world, a world fashioned after their selfish conceptions of an ideal existence. Each sought a world at peace which would personify their egotistic dreams. Even within the lifespan of most of us, another megalomaniac strode across the stage of history. He sent his troops blazing across Europe, bringing havoc and Holocaust in his wake. That is grave irony in the fact that Hitler could come forth following the nakedly aggressive expansionist theories he revealed in Mein Kampf and do it all in the name of peace. So when I see in this day the leaders of nations similarly talking peace while preparing for war, I take frightful pause. When I see our country today intervening in what is basically a civil war, destroying hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese children and adults with napalm, and sending home half men mutilated mentally and physically. When I see the recalcitrant unwillingness of our government to create the atmosphere for a negotiated settlement of this awful conflict by halting bombings in the North and agreeing to talk with the Viet Cong, and all this in the name of pursuing the goal of peace, I tremble for our world. I do so not only from dire recall of the nightmares wreaked in the wars of yesterday, but also from dreadful realization of today's possible nuclear destructiveness and tomorrow's even more damnable prospects. The past is prophetic in that it asserts loudly that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. One day we must come to see that peace is not merely the distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. How much longer must we play? How much longer must we play at deadly war games before we heed the plaintive pleas of the unnumbered dead and maimed of past wars? Why can't we at long last grow up and take off our blindfolds, chart new courses, put our hands to the rudder and set sail for the distant destination, the port city of peace? President John F. Kennedy said on one occasion, "Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind." How true this is. Wisdom born of experience should tell us that war is obsolete. There may have been a time when war served as a negative good by preventing the spread and growth of an evil force, but the destructive power of modern weapons eliminates even the possibility that war may serve as a negative good. If we assume that life is worth living, and that man has a right to survive, then we must find an alternative to war. In a day when vehicles hurtle throughout a space and guided ballistic missiles carve highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can claim victory in war. A so-called limited war will leave little more than a calamitous legacy of human suffering, political turmoil, and spiritual disillusionment. A world war, God forbid, will leave only smoldering ashes as a mute testimony of a human race whose folly led inexorably to ultimate death. So if modern man continues to flirt unhesitatingly with war, he will transform his earthly habitat into an inferno such as even the mind of Dante could not imagine. I do not wish to minimize the complexity of the problems that need to be faced in achieving disarmament and peace, but I think it is a fact that we shall not have the will, the courage, and the insight to deal with such matters unless in this field we are prepared to undergo a spiritual and a mental reevaluation, a change of focus, which will enable us to see that the things which seem most real and powerful are indeed now unreal and have come under the sentence of death. We need to make a supreme effort to generate the readiness, indeed the eagerness, to enter into the new world which is now possible. We will not build a peaceful world by following a negative path. It is not enough to say we must not wage war. It is necessary to love peace and sacrifice for it. We must concentrate not merely on the negative expulsion of war, but on the positive affirmation of peace. That is a fascinating little story that is preserved for us in Greek literature about Ulysses and the sirens. The sirens had the ability to sing so sweetly that sailors could not resist steering toward their island. Many ships were lured upon the rocks, and men forgot home, duty, and honor as they flung themselves into the sea to be embraced by the arms that drew them down to death. Ulysses, determined not to be lured by the sirens, first decided to tie himself tightly to the mast of his boat, and his crew stuffed their ears with wax. But finally, he and his crew learned a better way to save themselves. They took on board the beautiful singer Orpheus, whose melodies were sweeter than the music of the sirens. When Orpheus sang, who bothered to listen to the sirens? So we must fix our vision not merely on the negative expulsion of war, but upon the positive affirmation of peace. We must see that peace represents a sweeter music, a cosmic melody that is far superior to the discords of war. Somehow we must transform the dynamics of the world power struggle from the negative nuclear arms race, which no one can win, to a positive contest to harness man's creative genius for the purpose of making peace and prosperity a reality for all of the nations of the world. In short, we must shift from the arms race into a peace race, if we have the will and determination to mount such a peace offensive. We will unlock hitherto tightly sealed doors of hope and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against it not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all, with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I am disappointed with America. There can be no great disappointment where there is not great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. Jesus once told a parable of a young man who left home and wandered into a far country, where in adventure after adventure and sensation after sensation, he sought life, but he never found it. He found only frustration and bewilderment. The further he moved from his father's house, the closer he came to the house of despair. The more he did what he liked, the less he liked what he did. After the boy had wasted all, the famine developed in the land, and he ended up seeking food in a pig's trough. But the story does not end there. It goes on to say that in this state of disillusionment, blinding frustration and homesickness, the boy came to himself and said, I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. The prodigal son was not himself when he left the father's house or when he dreamed that pleasure was the end of life. Only when he made up his mind to go home and be a son again did he really come to himself. The parable ends with the boy returning home to find a loving father waiting with outstretched arms and a heart filled with unutterable joy. This is an analogy of what America confronts today. Like all human analogies, it is imperfect, but it does suggest some parallels worth considering. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. The home that all too many Americans left was solidly structured idealistically. Its pillars were soundly grounded in the insights of our Judeo-Christian heritage. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It has driven wisdom from her sacred throne. This long and callous sojourn in the far country to racism and militarism has brought a moral and spiritual famine to the nation. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to return to her true home of brotherhood and peaceful pursuits. We cannot remain silent. As our nation engages in one of history's most cruel and senseless wars, America must continue to have, during these days of human travail, a company of creative dissenters. We need them because the thunder of their fearless voices will be the only sound stronger than the blasts of bombs and the clamor of war hysteria. Those of us who love peace must organize effectively as the war hawks. As they spread the propaganda of war, we must spread the propaganda of peace. We must combine the fervor of the civil rights movement with the peace movement. We must demonstrate, teach, and preach until the very foundations of our nation are shaken. We must work unceasingly to lift this nation that we love to a higher destiny, to a new plateau of compassion, to a more noble expression of humaneness. I have tried to be honest today. To be honest is to confront the truth. To be honest is to realize that the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of convenience and moments of comfort, but where he stands in moments of challenge and moments of controversy. However unpleasant and inconvenient the truth may be, I believe we must expose and face it if we are to achieve a better quality of American life. Just the other day, the distinguished American historian Henry Steele Cominger told the Senate Committee, and I quote, Justice Holmes used to say that the first lesson a judge had to learn was that he was not God. We do tend, perhaps more than other nations, to transfer our wars into crusades. Our current involvement in Vietnam is cast increasingly into a moral mold. It is my feeling that we do not have the resources, material, intellectual, or moral, to be at once an American power, a European power, and an Asian power. I agree with Mr. Cominger, and I would suggest that is another kind of power that America can and should be. It is a moral power, a power harnessed to the service of peace and human beings, not an inhuman power, and least against defenseless people. All of the world knows that America is a great military power. We need not be diligent in seeking to prove it. We must now show the world our moral power. That is an element of urgency in our redirecting American power. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant in every plea. It rushes on. Over the bleached bones and cluttered wreckage of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. History will record the choice we make. It is still not too late to make the proper choice. If we are to decide to become a moral power, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of this world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. If we make the wise decision, we will be able to transform our pending national and cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. This will be a glorious day. If we will only do it, we will speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, Easterners and Westerners, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
This program is from the Pacifica Radio Archive. For more information or to get copies, call Pacifica, area code 818-506-1077, or write to Post Office Box 8092, Universal City, California, 91608-0092.
The Institute for Policy Studies, the Wallace Global Fund, and The Nation invite you to their first annual Henry A. Wallace Symposium, Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland, on Monday, July 22nd from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Speakers include National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation, John Nichols, Soma Arias of People's Action, and IPS Executive Director Tope Falerin. That's Countering American Fascism, Lessons from Organizing in the U.S. Heartland, Monday, July 22nd, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the 14th and V Streets Busboys and Poets. More information and how to RSVP can be found online, ips-dc.org/events/Countering American Fascism. WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW. Summertime is here. Words Beats in Life and Arts for Everybody have the event for your family and friends this season. DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 27th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness, featuring musical acts, Chuck Brown Band, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Substantial, Belladonna, DuPont Brass, and just added, The Blackbirds, celebrating 50 years of their classic, Rock Creek Park, plus four more music and dance stages, Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, live art installations, hands-on workshop tent, and health and wellness pavilion. Free to the entire community. July 27th on the National Mall. DMV Made Festival. Get more information and RSVP today. WBLINC.org/DMVMade.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Vice President Kamala Harris made her first public remarks today since President Joe Biden dropped out of the presidential race and endorsed her for the role. Harris made her speech on the White House South Lawn at an event celebrating NCAA athletes who won championships for the 2023 to 2024 season. During her remarks, Vice President Harris spoke highly of President Biden's character, naming his honesty, integrity, and commitment to faith and family. She said, and I quote, "I am a firsthand witness that every day our president, Joe Biden, fights for the American people, and we are deeply, deeply grateful for his service to our nation," end quote. She also praised his presidency, saying that, quote, "In one term, he has already surpassed the legacy of most presidents who have served two terms in office," end quote. Vice President Harris said yesterday that she's honored to have earned President Biden's endorsement and said her intention is to earn and win the nomination. It's been over a week since the assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump at his Pennsylvania rally. Today, Kimberly Cheadle, the Secret Service director, testified in front of Congress about the incident. She described the attempt on Trump's life as the Secret Service's, quote, "most significant operational failure in decades." Reports indicate that the 20-year-old shooter was spotted by local law enforcement and other rally attendees well before he opened fire. For instance, he was seen climbing up the side of a building that was within 157 yards from the stage where Donald Trump would stand. It was atop that building that the shooter laid down and set up his AR-style rifle, having a detonator for explosives in his pocket. During today's congressional hearing, lawmakers grilled Director Cheadle about why Trump was allowed to take the stage after local law enforcement had identified the man as suspicious. Cheadle said she took full responsibility for the lapses in security, and she vowed to, quote, "move heaven and earth to make sure there's no repeat of it." To your local news, in New York City, as the migrant crisis continues, so is the shoplifting crisis. One city store owner has been blindsided by rampant shoplifting since waves of illegal immigrants flooded the area, and is leaving him to wonder if his business will survive or not. Chris Ciaccio, the owner of Kaya's Pallets in Queens, New York, says his business gets targeted by thieves as many as six times each week. He said, and I quote, "It's not fair that these people can come into my store and steal willy-nilly and nothing gets done about it," end quote. Talking about the impact of the thieveries, Ciaccio said his store has suffered a $3,000 a month loss, and unless something changes, he will be left with no choice but to cancel his lease. In the D.C. area, Israel's President Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to arrive today in the district and meet with President Biden this week and address Congress on Wednesday. Due to his visit, some road closures are in place that started yesterday and are expected to last through Saturday, July 27th. According to one outlet, there will be tons of road closures around the Watergate Hotel on Virginia Avenue in Northwest D.C. For instance, for this week, some streets are posted as emergency no parking through Saturday, July 27th at 3 p.m., such as Virginia Avenue Northwest from Rock Creek Parkway to New Hampshire Avenue. Also, some streets will be closed to vehicle traffic until Friday, July 26th at 6 a.m., such as Rock Creek Parkway Northwest between Virginia Avenue and the Potomac River Freeway southbound. In today's weather, it's currently about 82 degrees in New York and 75 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.